Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, the latest geek culture news, and whatever movies, TV, and other pop culture is on our radar for the week. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. All right, we are doing our big 150th extravaganza podcast.
Right.
And because it's our 150th podcast, we have done something very special, which is nothing special.
Actually, Randy, I'm going to be lifting barbells throughout this.
Oh,
so
yeah.
If I groan occasionally, it's just me doing my reps.
And Nick is doing yo-yo tricks.
Yep.
I will be juggling.
We should really do a video cast of that. But
I feel like it would only deprive us of the magic. Yeah. I think it's better audio only. So just imagine this entire podcast that Nick is doing yo-yo tricks, Dave is lifting barbells, and I am juggling. that's going on.
And Randy's also dressed as a juggalo.
Also dressed as a juggalo. But that's every day. Every day I'm juggaloing.
Jug life.
the thing we did sort of promise is we were going to talk about like the best stuff on the clearance sale.
Yes.
We forgot to do that, so we might do that next week.
Right. Well, you know, we had like our credit card machine had some problems.
Yes.
Day, and
there were things.
There was tech support calls for hours on end, and it's all good now, but it did take away from our time.
Yep. I'd apologize for not being here, but I was at home watching Facebook and the death of our republic.
Fair enough.
So I feel like I struggled in my own way. But we do have a clearance sale going on right now. We've got two tables full of, like, there's some Games Workshop stuff, there's RPG stuff, lots of board games, lots of graphic novels.
Right. I remember, like, among other things, there's some very nice Carl Barks, like Uncle Scrooge and Donald Duck hardcovers. There's plenty of stuff from Marvel and DC, and am I correct that some of their the Azzarello Wonder Woman?
Yeah, some of the Azzarello Wonder Woman hardcovers are on there.
Yeah, there's for sure some awesome stuff.
And the way that works is that you get 35% off, and then you roll two dice, and you get that additional percentage. So it's
37 to 47 is what you'll end up hitting.
Correct. And if you are a Rogue card member, you automatically get 47%.
Yep, you just go straight to the top.
That's right. You just show your card. We're like, boom, critical hit.
Yes.
Then in about 3 weeks, February 18th, that Saturday, will be our Gaming with Rogues playing Love Letter this month. Because, you know, Valentine's Day.
Ah.
Yeah.
Ah.
So come out for that. It's always fun. And now I'll hit the news. So, first of all, this is almost a non-news story, but I think we're all kind of excited about the possibilities. There is a teaser out there for a new Avengers video game by Square Enix, Crystal Dynamics, and Eidos. These are
really,
people.
All of them?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're all pairing up.
So there's like Tomb Raider, Deus Ex, Final Fantasy.
Yeah, they have some games of note behind them.
There's some credible people.
Yeah. The teaser is not super exciting. It's just a picture like some of they show the hammer, they show Iron Man's gauntlet. It's cool looking. They don't give us any indication what the game's going to be like.
Yeah.
But I'm excited about this.
I mean, just that those people are working on a Marvel game.
Yeah.
I mean, that is something to be excited
Do they have
for.
A... I mean, is there even a pitch as to what kind of game it is?
No idea.
No.
Okay. But if it's Avengers, we presume there's going to be... yeah, like, that would be my dream, is some kind of XCOM-type game, turn-based, recruiting different members for different missions.
But that's not really what these guys do, right? They do more like...
Final Fantasy is nothing like Tomb Raider. Those are vastly different games. So it could turn out to be anything. I don't think it's going to be a turn-based game.
No.
I strongly suspect it will be some kind of action game. You know, it could update on the old, isometric ones? They did one for X-Men.
Ultimate Alliance?
Yeah, Ultimate Alliance and stuff like that.
Those were fun.
But I bet it's going to be something kind of new.
I
bet they're going to bring something, some sort of new format to the table. I don't know.
I hope this is the game where D-Man and Wonder Man get their day, finally.
You know, if they're doing Avengers and they want to have a broadcast, you know, for recruitment in it, I could actually see that. And even, like, downloadable skins. Get Wonder Man in the red jacket. Get him in his ugly original costume.
But I'm going to guess this will be the five from the movie. Look, based on the trailer, it looks like they're doing the movie Avengers.
Was there actually a trailer that had video to it? I guess I didn't see it.
It showed, like, say, Iron Man's gauntlet, Thor's hammer.
But they were all damaged.
Cap's shield, maybe?
Yeah, weren't they all, like, damaged?
Yeah, it
though?
Seemed like,
and it said reassemble?
Yeah. Oh.
So is that? I mean, that could be a open up the Marvel Universe a little bit for you to recruit your own Avengers team or something.
It could be. I don't know. I have little faith that they're going to do this. Although Ultimate Alliance did have a lot of sort of obscure characters in it.
Yeah. And I mean, you consider all the like the Lego games and stuff going on now.
Yeah.
And how many people like have come to know the a lot of those IPs that are used to be thought of as just like completely bizarre.
Yeah.
Didn't the X-Men Ultimate Alliance game start out with Magma? I mean, come on.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Just saying, it's within the realm of possibility.
It is within the realm of possibility.
But it also could be a kind of a game where you, you know, play, realistically rendered versions of the characters as they try and put together an Avengers Destroyed.
Yep.
And, you know, it's like, oh, you start out, you know, learning the basics with Cap, and then you get to add Thor to your mix, and you can swap out between them, and if you have a friend, they can play as one of the other Avengers, and, you know, up to five people could play at once to play the whole team.
What if it's a fighting game that only pits Wonder Man versus D-Man?
Then I guess we'll be playing that, right?
Yes, it is a game made just for us.
I'm going to go ahead and call dibs on Wonder Except, Man.
You know what? Neither of us really likes fighting games that much.
Yeah, that's true.
Wouldn't that suck? They finally made a game, and it's like a fighting game.
I don't think with that pedigree we'll get a fighting game.
It's going to be a text-based adventure game.
You enter a room. There is a red safari jacket. Put on jacket.
Zork 5, Avengers 1.
Yes.
Dang, I played the hell out of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy text game.
I know. I love those games.
Yeah, me too. I don't think
they could ever be recreated in the modern times, but I love the minimalism.
Yeah, I feel like it's only nostalgia.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the thing is, it did offer something that, you know, graphics cannot do. It had something of the open world nature of, like, it's almost like the difference between a MMO RPG, like, you know, World of Warcraft, and a tabletop RPG where you can do whatever the hell you want.
Because it had the graphics of the mind.
That's actually true. And you can type in whatever the hell you wanted, and sometimes it would say you couldn't do it, but you could try it.
Like, if you were a kid and you were playing, you'd type in boobies, because that's what you did.
Yeah.
I mean, 9 times out of 10, it wouldn't do what you asked.
That's right.
you were still, like any game, you had to sort of learn what it broadly wanted you to do. If you went into the Avengers Mansion, you couldn't say, punch Jarvis. It would be like, why would you want to do that? Or something like that.
He punches you back.
But you could go wander around anywhere you wanted in it. You could look at all kinds of cool stuff. You mess with computers.
So, Millie Bobby Brown has apparently going to be in Godzilla King of the Monsters.
Yes.
Millie Bobby Brown, by the way, has a great name.
Right, and she also to be reminded she's 11 from Stranger Things.
Yeah,
because I didn't like that
for
show.
For a second there, I thought I heard you say Mini Bobby Brown.
Mini Bobby Brown. That I would watch that.
It's his mini prerogative.
What if there are two Mini Bobby Browns and they are the ones who summon Mothra?
So she's going to be in the movie?
Yeah.
Do we know anything else?
I'm guessing that she is. She summons Mothra.
Is it going to be as boring as the other one?
Probably. I don't know. Same director?
I don't think it's Gareth Edwards, okay. Is it?
Okay.
I think it's somebody different.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, we here at the table are not the biggest Godzilla fans.
No.
From what little I've seen, she seems like a talented actress. I would worry that her abilities might be wasted sort of in a big action, especially a big monster kind of thing.
You mean like Bryan Cranston's were?
Exactly like that. Exactly like that. So it's going to take a special touch from whoever the director is going to take some work.
Into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's fine.
She'd have to at some point.
She'll be cast as...
she would have been like X-23 if that role wasn't already stolen.
Yeah, yeah.
But yes, somebody will turn up.
Speaking of the Marvel Universe and shifting over to the DC one, Ben Affleck is not directing Batman anymore.
By the way, I figured out before who she should be in the Marvel Universe.
Who's that?
She will voice, and then she could probably physically play in a few years, Viv, the daughter of Vision, if they could come up with a movie variant of that.
I like it.
Paul Bettany does him, so he has an English accent.
Yep.
Yeah. She's English, right?
I don't know, could be.
She's
not English.
Fake English?
I don't think so.
Is she not?
I don't think so.
I don't know. I didn't watch that show. Anyway, I thought she was English.
I mean, in the show, she certainly wasn't English.
Oh, okay. I thought she might have had an English accent.
No.
All right.
No. That's just that English accent you hear in your head for everybody.
All right. Well, then it looks like Vision's daughter ain't going to have an English accent.
Yep.
But she will be playing her.
Ah, you're confirming.
Yes. Yep. I was going to confirm it. People can put their money on that for their Vegas bets. All right, what were we talking about?
DC. We're talking about Ben Affleck not directing Batman anymore.
Yep. Did anybody read up? Is there specifics that he?
There are no specifics. He did a sort of. We all want what's best for the characters. I'm still going to be playing him. I'm going to help them find the best director. We're all speculating at this point. They're not going to say what happened until like 10 years when the tell-all book comes out. But it reads to me like every other DC direction, which is DC's really hands-on with this stuff.
You know, though, I will say this. It sounded like everything I was hearing what he was wanting to do with it, it sounded like he was really immersed in method and hyper-serious and honestly more of the...
Frank Miller style.
Well, not Frank Miller, but what were the previous three movies? Nolan. More Nolan style. And if the word from is true that they're kind of trying to lighten up the tone for Justice League and Wonder Woman and stuff like that, he might have found that his sort of personal visions, which was going to be like, I definitely remember hearing some darker stuff from him.
Were sort of colliding.
Colliding with it, and he was legitimately a poor fit for it, you know. And that is editorial or sort of, you know, Warner Brothers oversight stuff. But in this case, it actually could be a good thing.
Yeah, it could be a good thing.
Look, I mean, I doubt they're going to get a director as good as him.
Yeah.
But it's going to save us from getting another Nolan light or...
But I mean, now that with him out as Batman, they still haven't filled the Flash role. All
right, he's still going to portray him, right? He's still going to be
in it.
He's going
to play Batman, yeah.
Yeah, but no one's directing it. No one's directing Flash. But James Wan is still having fun directing Aquaman. I think that's starting to shoot soon.
Sounds like, yeah. Aquaman's going to be the big success.
Unless James Wan drops out of that one halfway through.
I don't think... I think once you start principal shooting, it's harder and harder to drop out.
Yeah. That's another cynical thing Randy can say, though.
Yep. That's true.
And we have to go ahead and let him expend all of them, or he can't go on.
That's true.
This whole podcast could just be that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Send it off to Randy. You guys want to do a podcast where I was bitch about DC's movies for an hour? I can do it.
But anyway, so yeah, that's up in the air. Who knows how it'll play out.
As long as Batman is still branding people, I'm okay with it. I just want to make sure that's still
there. He stopped branding people at the end of Batman vs. Superman.
Oh, that's good. That's nice.
He turned a new leaf. He became sane again.
I'm done branding people now.
He went insane. He became sane again.
I've had enough of it. I branded too many people. we have our casting for Cloak and Dagger.
Right. I was like, I don't know who they are. They got a white girl and a black dude, and I was like, so right on for them.
The casting is Aubrey Joseph, who I know from The Night Of.
Okay,
he was the dude who was like bumped into him on the... You've seen Night Of, right?
Yeah.
He was
is that a TV show?
Basically, yeah, it was HBO show. The main character coming out of the...
Yeah, yeah.
Coming out of the crime scene.
I liked him. I could definitely see him playing Cloak.
How old is he? What's the age we're going to?
20s. 20s.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, those are not... Well, they're probably going to play teens.
Probably.
Probably.
Traditionally, Cloak and Dagger were teenagers.
Yep. It's hard to get actual teenagers to act. Unless you want to act mopey and sad.
That is actually a little weird to me. Unless you're going for that right as they're hitting puberty age, when like literally they're going to start looking different and voice changing and stuff like that. I'm sort of surprised you wouldn't go for somebody who's like, you know, 17 or 18, maybe.
There's not a lot of good 17. I mean,
there are good 17 or 18-year-old actors out there, I am sure of it. Look, all the kids on Stranger Things were good actors, and those were, like, young actors. There's for sure good teen actors.
Nobody casts
them. One.
Oh, well, I'm not... you might be right that they're not casting, but I think it's for reasons other than that. I think it's... I think that they don't want people whose looks are going to change, probably.
Maybe.
You guys cannot tell me that every high school drama department is filled with lame-os.
They all are. They're all filled with lame-os.
All bad.
But there's some magical point between the kids' age on Stranger Things and adults at which people cease learning to act.
The kids on Stranger Things are the exception to the rule. Most kid actors are pretty bad.
Sure, but I've seen tons and tons of good kid actors in movies.
I don't know. I don't know how old he is, but, I mean, you know, we all watch Riverdale. They were all in their 20s. Yeah. It's actually one of the problems with it, to be honest. But we'll get to that later. At any rate, The Night Of is really good. She is a Disney actress.
Okay.
She's been in Disney shows, which, you know, there's a lot of good actresses who come out of the Disney machine. Yeah. So
if I'm not... What's... oh, man, I'm blanking on her name. Was the actress who was in Les Mis, Nick?
Which one?
He's yo-yoing.
Don't stop him. He's around the world.
Lead actress in Les Mis.
Keira Knightley? No.
No.
I'm trying to...
Oh, man, who was the lead actress in Les Mis?
She played Mary Poppins in the SNL spoof.
Oh, Anne Hathaway.
Anne Hathaway. Yep. She didn't start out as a Disney actress, did she?
I don't think so.
No.
Okay, for some reason I was thinking she was like the very upper echelon of what you might get.
No, because she did The Princess Diaries, which was a Disney movie.
That's what I was thinking of.
And she also played Mary Poppins in a hilarious sketch on a Saturday Night Live.
Right, look that up on YouTube, y'all. Yes. It's the best.
It is not safe for work.
Yeah.
All right, well, I guess it is safe
for work. It's not
wild. I was just trying to find what all Olivia Holt had done, so, but... Yep. Doesn't matter.
Olivia Hoff is her name. That might be where I have trouble finding it.
No, it's Holt.
What? No, it's Olivia Hoff.
I remember that from
the press release.
Did I just write it down wrong?
She was in the Sweet Life with Zach and whatever.
The Sweet Life with Zach and whatever.
And whatever that show is with the Magic Kids.
yep. Are we sure it's Olivia Holt?
Because
Olivia Hoff was in Amazing Spider-Man.
I mean, Olivia Holt is what comes up when I type it into Google. She definitely looks like
Jagger. Yeah, that's her. Ah, she was in Kickin' It, and I didn't do it.
I love Kickin' It.
Yeah. It looks like something about karate. Once a generation of young karate fighter named Jack joins the Wasabi Warriors.
Anyway. I think we all hope the best for Cloak and Dagger.
Yes.
It's coming out from... Isn't it Disney Family or something like that?
It's Freeform, which was ABC Family.
She's like 19 years old right now. So she actually is a 19-year-old.
Well, she's probably going to be a bad actress by y'all's metric.
Yep. Until they're 22, their acting stinks.
Yeah. But anyway, that sounds like halfway decent casting, though.
Yeah. They got the look at any rate.
Yep.
So I'm curious about it. Oh, this was interesting. There's a little bit of synopsis in there.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like they did away with the drug thing entirely. Not shocking.
Yeah,
it sounds like the two of them are sort of like they're having their separate lives. They meet, and maybe when they meet, it somehow triggers their powers. It's builds a romance. So they're actually going to be doing the romance thing, which they always kept that. They're sort of very close. But it was very much an unrequited thing between...
It was X-Files-y in that sense.
Yeah.
Like a Mulder and Scully kind of thing.
Well, except Cloak was 100% in love with Dagger.
I guess so, but I don't actually remember it being a big thing in the stories that I read.
I remember the issue where
There was definitely a sort of, I would do anything for her
thing.
But I don't remember. I don't know, maybe they just didn't get inside his head a lot in the issues I read.
He was always like monologuing about how she was so beautiful and he was too dark for her and all this kind of stuff. Yeah,
those comics might have been racist.
those comics.
All right, you guys want to talk about death?
I mean, sure, I guess.
So a couple notable deaths recently. 2017 is not 2016 levels, but there have been some deaths.
Yeah.
Well, Masaya Nakamura, who is the creator of Pac-Man, died.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know. He hadn't gone on to become necessarily the superstar that Shigeru Miyamoto or whatever from the Super Mario
game. Right, but wasn't he in the movie Pixels or whatever?
I think you're right. I think he was the one who got eaten by Pac-Man.
Yeah,
in their kind of dumb joke.
Yeah, that's not the best way to close out your career.
Yeah.
Would have been better if he'd actually been eaten by Pac-Man.
but yeah, for sure the dude started a revolution.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, obsessed with Pac-Man.
Yep.
Watched Pac-Man TV show. Drew Pac-Man. And the ghost and stuff. And played a lot of the video game. What was I going to say about that? Among my Pac-Man memories, the terrible Atari 2600 game that came out, which was a horrible adaptation. Then they adapted Ms. Pac-Man, and that was like everything that was the best the Atari could do.
Yeah.
It was very good.
Yep.
Did y'all, but I actually do remember playing Pac-Man in the arcade. What about y'all?
Yep, I definitely played Pac-Man in the arcade.
I played Mrs.
Pac-Man. I have very specific memories of like, I don't know if it was like swim class or something that we, like they had it like one arcade machine in there and we'd play Ms. Pac-Man after we got done.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I guess they had two because they also had Defender, but Defender was hard.
Defender was hard. You had to have some sort of, you had to be on speed to play it, I think.
Yeah, and I was not on speed at that point.
anyway. That's sad to lose the guy who basically created the sort of modern video game.
Yeah.
He was 91. I mean,
that's a good run.
Saying he deserved it?
No, I was not saying he deserved it. No one deserves to die.
I think that his casket, his pallbearer, should be Blue Ghosts.
That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah. And then should make that noise when they take him to the grave. Waka 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 waka.
No, we discussed this. He has to make the.
That's just sad. I would cry if I.
But like, what if he requested it? What if he has a sense of humor?
If he requested it.
He was in Pixels. He's got to have some kind of sense of humor. Or maybe he doesn't. Maybe that's why he was in it.
Guys, I'm going to go on record right now. When I die, I would like you to dress up as Blue Ghost to carry my casket. And when I go down to the ground, I would like you to play the Pac-Man death song.
Here's how I see that playing out in the newspapers the next day. Two men in blue ghost costumes arrested at funeral.
I'm just going to all dress up as ghost characters.
No, no.
Like Space Ghost, yes. Blue Ghost.
You had misinterpreted it. And the one who was dressed as the ghost from Star Wars Rebels.
Uh-huh.
No, see, this is recorded evidence now. You'd be like, see, he told us.
That's right.
Yep.
That ought to get us out of jail.
All these jokes I make are actionable. Also sad, John Hurt died, I believe of cancer, which he'd been fighting for a while.
Yeah. John Hurt, legit one of the most amazing actors. One of the great character actors of our time. Unmistakable.
People know him from Alien.
Unmistakable voice, yeah. He was... he was the guy who died in Alien, right? He was the first.
Yep.
He was the chest burster.
And he reprised that role in Spaceballs.
In Spaceballs, yeah. In the sort of geek realms, he had done the voice of Hazel, the lead rabbit in Watership Down.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reminded was Aragorn in the Ralph Bakshi production of Lord of the Rings.
Also Control in V for Vendetta.
Yep. Yes. He is.
Although not a sort of a geek genre thing, it's sci-fi and, of course, wildly relevant to our times, the lead in the 1984 movie.
That's right.
So,
also Doctor Who.
What's that?
He was the War Doctor.
Yeah.
He is kind of admired in geek culture completely.
Yeah. Yep. If I'm not mistaken, was he the guy in the opening of Force Awakens, the trusted friend of the...
No, that was Max von Sydow.
Yeah, it's Max von Sydow.
Oh, that's right. I'm mixing up my dudes.
Yeah. All white dudes look alike to you, Dave.
That is
true. John, he's been in literally, I'm sure, 100 movies, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I suspect more.
Yep.
But yeah, that's definitely a sad one to see him go, because that dude was legit.
Yep.
There are some people, if you don't know him really well, check out a few clips on YouTube. There's lots of stuff of him showing his chops out there.
All right, we'll be back in just a second to talk about comics for the week. All right, we are talking comics for the week of Wednesday, February 1st. Dave, kick us off.
I had a pleasant surprise today. A book I had forgotten was coming out, a sequel to it's not Image Comics.
It is Image Comics.
Oh, it is Image. Okay, it's just...
They've got that 25th logo.
Oh, that's what's throwing me off.
And it looks like a Dark Horse logo.
So, a few years back, there was a comic that came out called Planetoid. It was a one-man show, right? He, like, wrote, drew, maybe even colored, I think, as well.
Yep.
Ken Gehring. Did everything out of this book.
Story, art, lettering, driver of the Winnebago.
Yes. It was a really cool survivalist story set on this kind of planet of... Derelict alien planet. It was futuristic kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was a planet that had some kind of, I think, weird magnetic field that tended to pull in ships, and they would crash land on it and just become, you know, scavengers would take them down, because there was also, I think, sort of like, you know, leftover war robots and stuff.
Yeah, some kind of machine consciousness, yeah.
And there was no escape.
The point at which the story became really interesting for me, and by the way, this is a sequel to it called Planetoid Praxis that started this week, was, I think, really in the second issue when I realized this wasn't just going to be a raw survival or, like, you know, a grim sci-fi story, but that there were, like, there was a humanity to it that I thought was really interesting. When the survivors sort of start banding together and you kind of see how they're... their specific plans to reconstruct, you know, take to one of these derelict bases and turn it into like here's a plant where we can filter water, and, you know, here's how we can start growing crops and stuff like that. And they actually got into a little bit of just enough detail on it to kind of give you a sense of them really accomplishing something. I was really impressed with some of the almost manga style times when they would zero in on you know, how the characters go about something.
Yeah.
And in this, it's some time has passed, and I had forgotten a little bit about what happened in it. I knew that they survived and had, I think, not escaped the planet, as you might expect at the end of it, but had sort of formed a life on it. This one is interesting. It begins with sort of a wordless sequence for a while where this creepy H.R. Geiger-looking alien sphere ship lands, and a dude with this big sort of orb-like helmet, kind of weird-looking, starts prowling around the wreckage. He seems kind of a little bit more alien than some of the ones we've seen, but there is a little glimpse of sort of humanity from him as he takes out like one of these little ampules of water or something like that, and he plugs it into his helmet to drink. But then there's a little lizard nearby where he's sort of staying in some of the ruins, and he gives it some bits of water too. So you see that he seems to be kind of have some sort of, at least some sort of empathy. But when he shows up and he finds the characters that we know from the first one, who are now older, some of them, they have some kids, but they are definitely the characters of the first one. They are suspicious of him, and when they wrench the helmet off, they find he is one of the aliens who's kind of one of the oppressors that they know. And this sets up a big sort of moral dilemma. In losing the helmet, he actually loses the ability to speak. And they had talked to him just enough beforehand that he was presenting himself as more like a surveyor. But they think these guys, basically these, it'd be like if a Nazi showed up and was like, oh no, I'm just surveying, I don't know what's going on. And then you're like, oh, well, let's string him up.
Punch him. You punch Nazis.
And that's what everybody is ready to do, but we have sort of privately seen that this person may not be what they think he is. And the story is, so this first issue is kind of a bit of a moral dilemma as they're trying to figure out what to do. There's some of the characters from the beginning, from the first story, as well as a few others, hash it out, and it's clear that they've all been kind of hardened by their time here to the point where it's almost like there's not a real strong argument made for, oh, we should probably just let him go or save him. They're like, this guy will get us killed if we do it. Anyway, it reminds me of some of the tough decisions, honestly, in video games like Mass Effect and stuff like that, that kind of sci-fi. The story went in some interesting places from there. I don't want to reveal how it plays out in the first issue, but some unexpected stuff goes down, and I was immediately back on board. It reminded me of how much I had liked the previous one, and I feel like the writer, artist, letterer guy, Ken Gehring, also is depicts a place that feels physically real, sometimes by taking time to show the characters wandering around, interacting with the landscape and stuff like that. He's not a guy who's just going to like, I'm going to show you the cool futuristic city and then I'm just going to have characters dialoguing inside. He's like, no, you're going to get a sense of the movement within the city. So there's a strong sense of place as well.
As someone who remembers only that I liked Planetoid, but nothing else about it, mm-hmm. Do you need to have read the first one to read this?
I don't think so. I had honestly forgotten most of like the main character names in it. Because they kind of, it's more like there's like four or five people who are clearly kind of like, I don't want to say the village council, but it's almost like that's what they are for this. You'll quickly pick up on, oh, this guy is the very aggressive one. This person is a little more thoughtful. It's really all you need to kind of know for right now on them. And the rest will kind of, I think, reveal itself over time. It does make me want to go back and reread the first one, which completely stands alone. But I was reading in the afterword, it looks like he just sort of started to get some ideas for a follow-up. He had never intended to do a follow-up. He started to get some ideas, and that's what... And the full title, I should say, this is Planetoid Praxis. And I don't know if it's a, what, four issue? Six? Do you have another
I think idea? It's only two.
Oh, okay. That's interesting.
I could be wrong, but I think it's only two.
Well, very little brief one. But anyway, check it out. You don't have to have read the previous one, but I do recommend the previous one if you're interested.
Nick?
Well, let's talk about Darth Maul. He's got a new miniseries starting up this week.
He's got a red face, got a double lightsaber.
Double lightsaber.
Spikes on his face.
He looks devilish.
Looks devilish.
I really have to say that the Clone Wars and then subsequently in Rebels, they've done amazing things with Darth Maul.
They really did. They really did sort of change his character. Did you feel like that was in this series?
I think the beginnings of that, especially...
This is actually set before Phantom Menace, before some of that fleshing out that would come later.
He's sort of an attack dog at this point.
He is, and I like... This is written by Colin Bunn, so Sith from the Sixth Gun and whatever various Deadpool miniseries.
As well as X-Men.
But it's sort of showing Darth Maul as very impatient, which is...
He's straining at his leash.
Which is kind of odd for me.
Was how he was in The Phantom Menace.
Sort of. I mean, sort of.
He seemed pretty loyal.
Now we'll have our revenge. Let's do it.
Yeah, but he seemed... He did not... There was not a tension between him and Darth Sidious, but I like this better.
Yeah, and that's where that tension is, because he is very much... Let's, like you said, Dave, let's do this. I'm tired of waiting around. I never got that from Phantom Menace.
I mean, it was kind of a simmering anger. Like, he felt like, as few lines as he had, when he was talking to Sidious, he seemed like there was some bitterness in him, or like a strong need to go get revenge or something. And then, of course, you think about the scene at the end when the cage dog thing reminds me of him pacing while the force shield is up, where he's literally like a pacing dog.
Hey, was Darth Maul played by Ray Park?
Yes. He was.
Okay.
Well, and also, and this is not really a huge spoiler, but the creatures, to basically kill time, he goes after random hunts.
Yeah.
So think of him like a predator.
Right. It's like he can't go out and do his big mission yet, so he's like, I gotta work.
And it was kind of cool seeing the creatures from Force Awakens. Yep. Show back up in this.
Oh, it's the things that Han Solo was transporting, the big floppy things?
Wrathars.
Yeah, okay. And it's kind of interesting to see that.
I thought those were Atyugs from D&D.
they resemble Atyugs?
They're space Atyugs.
No, but I think just that sort of... I think Bun's got a good handle on the character and sort of bringing to the table something I wasn't expecting. And not really humanizing Darth Maul, but giving him more of a character than, George Lucas did.
Mainly defined as simply as kind of for his sort of quiet ferociousness in that movie.
And here you get different aspects of him. He's not just the fighter, he's also the pilot. I have to give it...
And he's also a chef.
He's also a chef.
By the way, Quiet Ferociousness is the name of my new scent that I'm releasing later this year.
I like it. And also, I love the art here. Luke Ross does an amazing job.
Yeah, he's really good.
Not only just the action-based, but I love the ships. I mean, Darth Maul's ship is awesome-looking. And just...
That ship appeared, like, for 2 seconds in the movie, as I recall.
It did. Yep. And... But they just... He gives it a great sense of uniqueness, and the action is fantastic. So, yeah, no, I really dug it. And then there's a fun little backup story by Chris
Iliopoulos
that focuses on one of his droids from the episode 1.
Like his little spy droids he had down on Tatooine looking for him.
And it's very cute, as you would imagine it would be from him. And I don't know. I just thought
Chris Iliopoulos of like G-Man and the Mini Marvels.
Mini Marvels, I thought it was a great first issue.
You know, he should do a full-on like mini Star Wars thing like he did with Mini Marvels.
I could see that.
It'd be fun.
I'm sure he'd like some of that...
Scotty Young money?
No, I was going to say, who's the guy who does all the little young Star Wars?
Oh, Brian Kiesinger.
No.
I don't know who you're talking about.
Jeffrey Brown?
Oh, Jeffrey Brown, yeah.
Turns
out there's a lot of people doing baby versions of characters.
Yep, I don't know which one are you talking about?
Brian Kiesinger is the guy who does the little Kylo Ren online.
He's
a Disney artist.
He's
a Disney animator, this sort of thing he does in a certain time. And Scotty Young is that guy who does stuff.
Yep.
He does just a few things.
The guy you were just talking about, is any of that official or is that just kind of his fan DeviantArt page or whatever?
I think he's got to at least have permission because he works at Disney as an animator. He's got to at least have permission to use it. Because I would think his bosses might look askance at it. But I don't know. I don't know. The people at Disney seem pretty cool about, chill about copyrights and public domain, so I'm sure they have no problem with it. Yeah.
Randy, what you got?
I am picking Hawkeye number 3. I have previously picked Hawkeye 1 and 2. This doesn't necessarily mean I love this book more than any other books. I'm not even sure it'll make my top 20 by the end of the year. It's just that it keeps coming out in lighter weeks, and I do really like it.
Mm-hmm. This is Kate Bishop.
Being a PI, a bad unlicensed PI in Los Angeles. And this is, she takes a dunk in the river. She quarrels with a police detective.
That's right, I thought you were going to say a dump in the river.
No, different.
Like, this is a weird comic.
Are still people mistaking her for regular Hawkeye?
No, not in this issue. This issue, she goes to a house party looking for somebody, and things don't go well. It's really fun. Her sort of snarkiness really, really resonates with me. This book was sort of pitched as Veronica Mars in the Marvel Universe, and that's kind of what it is, except that Veronica Mars was an excellent detective, and Kate Bishop is terrible at this.
She's really good at shooting things, though.
She doesn't do that much either, though. Mostly she seems to get pushed around and go into bad situations. So she has definitely adapted from her mentor, This feels a lot like the old Hawkeye book where he would just constantly was getting in trouble. And then when something needed to happen, when he needed to pull it out, he would do a reveal he was the greatest archer. They're definitely doing a sort of a sad sack failure take on it, which I kind of find funny.
So I do have a question. Is Kelly Thompson like creating a secondary cast for her?
To some extent, although they're not as memorable as, say, Grills and some of those guys. Like, she has a police detective. She has the client that she's helping out. I'm not feeling most supporting characters that much yet.
Okay.
But she's definitely doing it. I'm not plugging into them as much.
Okay.
I like it, though. It's a fun book. The other book that I liked, picked the first issue of this one, was Unstoppable Wasp number 2. Something weird about the Wasp, I've noticed. Every book she's in, she's different.
Yeah.
There's no consistent characterization of her. Like, Wade writes her one way. I forget where else she popped up, but she's written a different way there. And this one, Jeremy Whitley is writing her book, and she is portrayed as sort of a slightly out of touch since she grew up in, like, a Russian science lab, but sort of super optimistic, not unlike, say, Squirrel Girl, which if there's not a Squirrel Girl crossover with this book soon, they're really missing a trick. But her premise here is that she is going to go out and recruit girls scientists because the most smartest men in the Marvel Universe are all men. They never seem to grab all these genius girls. And then she's like, Moon Girl was the smartest girl in the universe, and she actually shows up in this issue. But this is her recruiting sort of a brilliant engineer who builds robots out of scrap, and then they have a team up with Moon Girl against a giant rat.
They gotta go get Riri Williams.
They might do that. So it's a lot of fun. It's got that sort of same quirky, goofy feel you get from, say, Squirrel Girl. Guest stars Jarvis, which is always a good thing. Not the computer, but the butler.
I'm not sure if they were still kind of doing much with him these days.
He's still around.
Yeah, that's right. I remember him showing up in Wade's Avengers recently.
He doesn't have like a miniseries all his own yet or anything, but he will.
I feel like out of all the interpretations, I like this one the best from Unstoppable Lost. I like that sort of lightheartedness.
Yeah.
As opposed to just another sort of...
He's sort of her guardian and also sort of following her around flustered as she keeps being this bundle of energy. It's kind of fun.
Poor Jarvis.
Dave, what's your backup?
My backup pick is from Dynamite Comics, the first issue of a new Spirit comic, which there's been many a Spirit revival over the years.
In fact, I think Dynamite did one recently with like Matt Wagner.
Yep. And I like Matt Wagner, but that one kind of fell flat for me, mm-hmm. or just didn't stand out from the crowd, I should say. There was a great one from Darwin Cook,
yep.
Where he did about a dozen issues.
12 issues, exactly. Yeah. Collected in
and
two trades.
That's about as good as I think it generally gets. Francesco Francavilla, who's you know what's in common with the two books I've picked this week? They are all one-man shows. He is writer, artist, and letterer on this.
Oh, interesting.
Which fits because Will Eisner was like one of those triple threats, and mm-hmm. if you're going to homage Will Eisner's famous detective, The Spirit,
yep.
It's pretty cool if you can pull that off.
Yep.
This storyline is called The Corpse Makers, and it's got the kind of noir look, the rain-swept city noir look that very often Will Eisner gave to his detective. It's interesting. There's visually, this is a strong homage to Eisner. Francesco Francavilla is an amazing artist mm-hmm. who can pull off just about anything. But there's a lot of those trademark Will Eisner storytelling qualities. And for folks who don't know him, he was one of the guys who started doing sort of cinematic pacing in comics, mood shots as opposed to just a hurry up and let's just get the story told shots. Mm-hmm. He did move his stories along at a brisk pace, but he started sort of timing and pacing as a real art form in comics. And he also would do formal experiments with no panel borders. So Francavilla follows up on that. Sound effects that are not computer generated, but are the artist kind of. It's always a very hand drawn look to everything that Eisner ever did, and Francavilla picks up on that. As far as the story goes, there's a murder at the beginning. And when the Spirit arrives on the scene to consult with the detective, or Chief Nolan, I guess, his Commissioner Gordon.
Dolan, right?
Yeah, it's Dolan.
Dolan, okay, yeah, yeah. Interestingly, they're like, Dolan is kind of like, we don't need you for every case, Spirit. I think we got this one. Yep. It seems pretty cut and dry. And the Spirit's like, okay. It's kind of like, he's not even like, no, I think there's something more. And he's like, okay. And so he hops back in his car with his faithful sidekick, who was the cannot help but kind of be sort of racist character from the days. He was like the young black sidekick, a little like Short Round in the Indiana Jones movies,
yep.
named Ebony White.
Yep.
he's still like a teenage kid, but sort of like Darwin Cook, they've pulled back a little bit from the servant thing a little bit.
Yeah, good call.
And he just calls him Eb most of the time, which is a decent little nickname. And they're like, hey, let's have a night off. Like, you know, we don't got to do anything. And Eb has cousin who's visiting town who seems to be caught up in some bad business. And I suspect his plot is going to feed into the main plot. There is definitely this is definitely a getting sort of the pieces in place. There is some action sequences that. Interestingly, focus zero in on like some bad guys. Like it's like he spends a little bit of time with some crooks and a shootout with the cops, and that reminded me of I don't know if people know this, but not every Spirit story, especially as the old newspaper strip went along, was about the Spirit. Sometimes it was about other people who would get caught up, and he was almost like, you know, it was like the episode Blink was to Doctor Who.
Yeah,
Doctor Who is in it. He kind of is there for like the finale and parts of it, but it's really about the people who are kind of in his web. And so there's a bit of that in this, too. And I thought it was interesting that it seems like Frank Avila is kind of trying to strike a balance between some noir action, traditional action adventure with the Spirit, some, you know, sort of pulp stuff, but a little bit of the lightness that the series had to, and some of its focus sometimes on other characters, peripheral characters. We have yet to hit a femme fatale, which was one of the other marks, but
yep.
I suspect before we're done, we will hit one.
Yep.
Anyway, really enjoyed the first issue. Beautiful artwork, because it's Frank Avila. I'm going to recommend this to fans of original Spirit, Darwin Cook's The Spirit, Frank Avila the artist, and comics with dudes with hats.
Good, yeah.
That's my thing. Nick, yo cheetah pick?
Let's talk about murder.
Okay.
And that is with Bullseye number one.
Nick, stop yo-yoing. He's got a knife.
I'm mixing it up. No more yo-yos.
No more yo-yos, pal.
What are we covering
this
here?
This is Bullseye number one.
Bullseye, the Marvel assassin, who is an archenemy of Daredevil and once killed Elektra?
Yes, and
that was my exposition.
Was once nicely part of the done. Hand, then he got out of that, and somebody broke his back, and then he was in a tank.
And now he's not.
Despite all these setbacks, broadly considered the deadliest assassin in the Marvel Universe, maybe accepting Elektra.
And I honestly don't know if I was wanting a Bullseye miniseries.
I wasn't.
And yet, Edberson has given me something that I actually thoroughly enjoy.
It's a good first issue. It's pretty relentlessly brutal.
Yeah, there's a parental advisory not for kids, and usually I'm like, meh.
Yeah.
This one, yes, no, very very strong violence.
There's a lot of murder in this.
There's a lot of murder, and just kind of...
Pointless chaos murder. You know what it is? It's like, there's a sequence in here where Bullseye is, like, getting a job, and while he's listening to this guy tell him that what the job might be... He is just casually flicking paperclips out the window and causing havoc in the streets.
Yeah. And it's mainly just because he's bored and murder is the only thing he knows.
And you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of like when you're playing Grand Theft Auto and you're playing a mission and then something goes wrong, so you just murder everyone around you with whatever weapon you have in hand.
Yeah.
It's like that.
That is basically what this miniseries is. I mean, there's definitely so more to it. It's an
excellent comic for sociopaths.
Yes.
But, I mean, this is the first time we're seeing Bullseye back to, like, full form.
Yep.
He is still the best assassin, and we see him take out a couple of marks, and he's just looking for the, basically, the job that will bring the most mayhem.
He's also a giant dick.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's, like, talking to his agent who gets him his jobs. He's a big jerk to him the whole time. The guys who hire him are like, hey, can you make it quiet? And instead of making it quiet, he blows up a house.
Yep.
And he's unapologetic about it. In fact, he seems like he did it on purpose.
Yeah.
And then the closer of the issue is the same kind of thing, which I don't want to give away.
The closer's great.
There's just like they're like, well, keep it quiet this time. And clearly Bullseye is interested in being splashy murdery.
But I really was impressed with the story.
The art is great.
Guillermo Arosana, which I don't know.
New artist, yeah.
But it's fantastic.
am I correct that I heard peals of dark laughter sometimes when you were reading this?
Yes.
Yeah, this is definitely darkly humorous. It's a Tarantino-esque.
It reminds me a lot of what Punisher Max was.
Oh, yeah, I could see that. Yeah,
Max didn't have too much humor in it.
At times it had some jokiness to it. A little bit. Darth Ennis couldn't help but inject that.
I do remember somebody carrying around a jar with his testicles in it.
And then there was a whole Barracuda thing, and that was like...
Yeah, he kind of did this larger-than-life kind of dark humor.
Yeah. Yeah, this was really more fun than I expected it to be. It is lots of murder.
And also introduces a new FBI character. And
her story is really interesting.
It is. It's not without its nuances.
Yeah.
I will say that. It's not just all chaos and murder.
Right, it's not all chaos and murder. It does
There's
have a story.
There's definitely more to it, but...
Yeah.
I was very surprised with this, and it makes me kind of curious what the Elektra book, I think, that comes out next week.
You know, the thing is I liked about this, Nick, was that like with Darth Vader and Thanos, in order to enjoy this character, you got to sort of set him against someone worse than him.
Yeah.
So they set him up against this guy who is very much a sadist and a torturer and a bad... Yeah. And he's going after a bad guy, so you can sort of enjoy him murdering all of them.
Because it is very weird to feel like you are rooting for Bullseye.
Yep, yep. Yeah, it was an interesting first issue.
Yeah.
What else is on your stack?
So I have... There's a trade that I wanted to mention. It's the Rebirth trade for Batman Detective Comics, which I know I loved. This has the first, I believe, 7 issues.
These are big trades.
They are really big trades. And Dave was remarking on it. They don't look big. But I think it's a new kind of paper stock or something. And it's just...
Right.
They're
thin,
just in fully
but tough.
Well, so it's got the intro story, and then does it also have the
Detective Comics didn't have a Rebirth issue. It went straight into the
right, but is it the first two story arcs, or is it the first
it's
one?
It's just the first story.
Oh, okay.
Really?
I thought the...
That one's seven issues.
Yeah,
that was actually a secondary kind of arc.
Oh, okay.
I think.
Well, it's all going sort of up against this new threat that are like Shadow Players and Gotham.
Right, right.
Yeah, the big thing with Detective is it's a teen book.
Yes. The third issue of Nova, which, I'm really enjoying this series. This one has Cosmo, it has Nowhere, basically everything I liked about the Abnett landing. And they're bringing in some of the Cancer Universe stuff, they're dealing with that Richard Rider was stuck in. So I really like what Dennis...
They had previously not exactly said how he had escaped that horrible place.
And I feel like we're getting more of a better realization of what that is as opposed to what Bendis did, which was like in a panel.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Fourth issue of Avengers, which is all about Kang. New issue of Batman, number 16, which starts the Iron Bane story arc, and...
Does that guest star Damian, Red Hood, and Nightwing, all the various Robins?
And it has them eating at a Batman-themed restaurant.
Okay.
It's called Bat Burger. It's one of the most craziest things I've seen in the Batman books, but it's also kind of hilarious.
There's still Tom King writing?
Yes, it's still Tom King. Nightwing number 14, which is Tim Seeley and Marcus Toe. And then All New X-Men number 1 MU, which is just sort of a fun little story set in the Monsters universe with All New Wolverine and Gambit.
That's a fun team up.
Yeah,
it's Monsters Unleashed. Basically, all of these, they've done at least, one or two previous MU books?
Last week was like, Avengers and Spider-Man Deadpool. This week is All New X-Men, and I feel like there's one other one.
Right, tying into the big crossover with the Marvel Monsters Unleashed. Showing how these people deal with kaiju.
And then there's a zero issue for Vampirella that's just a quarter if you want to give it a shot.
Dave?
So my other random stuff in here, there's a crossover going on with Planet of the Apes and Green Lantern. So if you enjoyed, say, like the Star Trek Green Lantern stuff going on recently, it seems like Green Lantern has become a surprisingly go-to crossover character for them.
You think it's a Green Lantern Lumberjanes?
I think so.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, suck it, Batman. Not all crossovers have to have you in a printer.
How about Big Trouble in Little China, Escape from New York, Green Lanterns, Die Hard 3?
How about this? Big Trouble in Little Chinatown, and Chinatown is the Jack Nicholson movie Chinatown.
Oh, I like it.
Just a thought.
Big Trouble in Little Chinatown, Armageddon 3, Green Lantern.
Yes.
Transformers 6.
Also on the Green Lantern front, I periodically have been peeking in on some of the Green Lanterns book. That's the sort of a... Buddy Cop one. And I kind of enjoyed the previous issue, which was a day in the life one. This latest issue has them going to Gotham, so it's sort of a big team-up with Batman. Simon Boz kind of butting heads with Batman and trying to figure out how... Talking about how, like, of all the stuff he's seen in the universe, Gotham is still one of the scariest places to go. And there's some interesting stuff in it.
That's an interesting concept.
There's a new issue of The Flintstones, the surprisingly awesome satire. I haven't had a chance to read this one, but...
I see Fred is playing some sort of...
they're playing, like, an Xbox version. Yeah. I just wanted to mention... I'm not a regular follower of, but I wouldn't be embarrassed if I was. My Little Pony, Friendship is Magic, hits issue 50.
Yep.
That series has proven immensely popular, brought in a new audience. I just hats off to it. I think they've done a good job.
Hooves off.
Actually. Hooves off. Nicely done.
Yes.
Oh! Ponies are dying.
All right, maybe not.
There is a new issue of Champions this week, which I've been enjoying every issue of. This one has a character about which with whom I have no interest, Gwenpool.
Yep.
But she's pretty well used in a story that also is kind of has one of those a little bit ripped from the headlines kind of stories about... dealing with sort of racism, xenophobia, and the veiled versions of it and overt versions of it, and kind of questions about what the team can do about sort of deeper-seated problems like that.
Yep.
Let's see. There was the second issue of Monsters Unleashed. Nick, you mentioned the crossover, but there's also the yep. main series continues and reveals a little bit more about like where the monsters might be coming from and has the sort of a sort of second wave of mega threats hitting. So, if you like the kaiju, this is the Marvel comic for you. And lastly, I wanted to mention that the first volume, DC has collected the first volume of Scooby Apocalypse. Another unlikely success where, they re-envision the Scooby-Doo guys in a setting that turns apocalyptic as a virus sort of starts turning lots of things into monsters or unleashing them on the world.
I hate when that happens.
I've generally liked this series from Keith Giffen and is it DeMatteis?
It's, yeah.
His old partner?
Giffen and DeMatteis, yeah. And then Howard Porter.
Which has some rethinks of the characters, some lightness, some dark stuff, and a slightly more sci-fi-ish take. Like, they don't take it super seriously, but, like, Scooby-Doo does actually have some, you know, limited, like, amped-up intelligence from experiments, and they're a little more thoughtful about their sort of world-building. It's been a fun ride. I'm going to say it's a sort of Resident Evil Scooby-Doo kind of thing. Randy, what else you got?
Just a couple here. Blood Blister number 1, which is a new horror book from writer Phil Hester and artist Tony Harris. Mm-hmm. Moon Knight number 11, which gives a little insight into Mark Spector's history as a mercenary and how he met Frenchie, as well as him going down to the depths to recover Crawley's soul. By the way, he's Moon Knight, so I don't know if any of it's actually happening, but it's all really well drawn by Smallwood. It's a very interesting book by Jeff Lemire, and I continue to really dig this take on it.
When you say going down to the depths, what are you talking about?
I mean, like the underworld.
Like hell?
No, the Egyptian underworld.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Yeah.
And then Star Wars 28 continues the backstory of Yoda, a little Jedi journal that Luke is reading as Yoda confronts danger to some children. So if you wanted some Yoda solo action, this is the Star Wars for you.
That's right. Was it Attack of the Clones? Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the most Yoda unleashed. I guess, you know, Revenge of the Sith did have him fighting Palpatine, yeah. too.
Although, you know what? This is him. I mean, he's still a badass in here, but this is definitely more of the understated Yoda as, like, wise teacher type.
Right. Not beast mode Yoda.
He does brandish a lightsaber at one point, although he doesn't ever do any flippy crazy things with it.
I appreciate that.
All right, we'll be back in just a second to talk about Riverdale and Split. Just real quick, we want to talk about a movie and a TV show that we saw this weekend. We're going to start with talking about the movie because we're going to go non-spoiler, very non-spoiler, because A, Nick hasn't seen it because he was a bum and didn't go with us.
It was a busy weekend.
And B... you really want to see this one knowing as little as possible about it.
Right. It's a good one to see in the theater, I think.
Yeah.
Although it's not like a big special effects extravaganza. This is M. Night Shyamalan's Split.
Yeah. And I honestly...
It's a suspense story.
The only reason I wasn't planning on seeing this in the theater. I don't see a lot of movies in theaters. But you and Mandy were like, hey, we're getting tickets. You want to go? And it's like, yeah, I kind of want to go. You had said really good things about it. Chris had said really good things about it.
Yeah.
And I knew... It's Shyamalan, and I knew that I had not liked Shyamalan movie in a while, but I also knew that I heard his last one was sort of a something of a return to form.
Yeah, Nick, I believe both you and I liked The Visit.
Yeah, I liked The Visit quite a bit.
So, this, you've seen the trailer. It is James McAvoy playing a guy with multiple personalities who kidnaps three teenage girls.
Yep.
You know what it reminded me of was the 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Yeah, I could see that.
Although this
I feel
was,
like it was more harrowing.
Yes, it was. Well, 10 Cloverfield Lane was definitely the question you were dealing with was, is there something going on, or was right. John Goodman's character crazy?
Right. Is he just kind of off, but yeah. a good guy, or is he actually dangerous yeah.
there
or whatever?
There was no doubt from the beginning that James McAvoy's character was crazy.
Yeah.
And dangerous. And, I mean, the first thing he says to him is something about, like, that he's going to eat them.
Yeah. His particular terminology is creepy.
Yeah.
The movie, without saying too much, because it's Shyamalan, there's some interest there.
Yeah.
Although, you know, I don't think, you know, it's not one of those things where, like, the big twists and turns, like, make or break it.
No.
I feel like it really functions as a sort of smaller suspense movie that I would say somewhat akin to Psycho, which they actually did show some trailers for. They showed some scenes from it when we saw it. No doubt, sort of based on, you know, Norman Bates having the multiple personality disorder and some of the creepy stuff in there. But it has sort of that smaller feel to it overall, but unnerving, definitely a get under your skin kind of thing. But it also uses, there's flashbacks.
Yep.
There are some scenes of, and I don't even want to say what it is, but there are scenes set outside of the captivity sequence stuff. Mm-hmm. That are really interesting that I didn't see on the trailers early on. So I was like, oh, there's this whole other side to the movie I didn't know anything really about.
You know, honestly, the trailer really, most of the stuff you see in the trailer is in the first 10 or 15 minutes.
Yep. Well, you know, I was thinking about this the other day, that some of Shyamalan's strongest earlier movies were ones where the trailers, what I remember, were just scenes from the movies.
Yeah.
So if you remember, Sixth Sense did the car accident scene.
Yep.
Unbreakable did the train scene where it's like the guy is just interviewing him about having survived it.
Yep.
I don't remember about Signs, but I feel like Signs of the Village also might have just shown a scene. And they're usually one of those scenes where you're like, oh, I want to know what happens after that.
Yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah. I really like this, and I would definitely recommend people go give it a look. And I have not been
to say it's kind of a bit of a return to form.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you kind of liked his earliest three or four movies, then you're probably going to get something out of this.
Yes, I really like and still actually own both Sixth Sense and Unbreakable.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think The Village, and Signs. I do like Signs. The Village is sort of where I dropped off a little bit. I liked it okay, but I have no need to ever see it again. And then I haven't seen anything
since. I actually enjoy rewatching The Village. I actually, there's a lot of, he stages stuff interestingly.
Yeah.
And so, like, even, you know, knowing, oh, I know what the ending is and all that. I enjoy watching Signs, and I like the acting and stuff in it.
You know what this is, Dave?
Huh?
This is a rare, usually, when we're on our spectrum.
Yeah.
Nick loves something, I like it okay, and you hate it.
Yeah.
This is a rare case where you are the pinnacle of the spit. Like, you really like Shyamalan stuff.
I am. I would say I'm an apologist for him.
Yeah.
I like suspense is one of my sort of favorite things in movies when they pull it off right. And he is usually kind of does sort of an unpredictable style of suspense. And there's almost always an underlying horror element. You know, we talked about, like in all four of his first, I would say, first four big movies, there's essentially some horror element.
Yeah.
And I like that. It kind of, he's a pretty good job of getting under my skin. I usually like his characters. I sometimes find his dialogue a little bit overly scripty.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
You know, like, okay, he's being a little clever here.
Yeah.
But that's like kind of my biggest complaint.
Well, and the point I was making though is that, you always really like his stuff.
Yeah.
Nick is probably in the middle, and then he's liked more of his stuff than I have.
I think I liked the original four, but and I liked what he wrote in Devil.
I really like Sixth Sense, and Sixth Sense and Unbreakable are great movies to me,
mm-hmm.
and I find that Signs is a good flawed movie, and I'd put The Village probably in that same category, and after that, I'd sort of put him in director jail. I certainly not forgiven him for Avatar.
Right. But would you say you've forgiven him now?
Yes, I did. I actually loved this.
Yeah.
So,
saying too much, much else, I think we're recommending people go catch it in the theater.
People should go catch it. And like I say, know as little as possible because I did and I really enjoyed it.
Well, you know, as cool as Mandy, who went to see it with us, she hadn't even seen the trailer.
Yeah, she had no idea what it was about.
So, yeah, that was very cool.
And McAvoy's great in it, by the way.
His different McAvoy's great. I actually liked all the casting in it. Yeah. And there's an older actress who plays a role who I don't even know who she is. I couldn't name the actress right now, but I thought she was really good, too.
All right. We are now going to, since we've all seen it, we'll do a spoiler review of Riverdale Episode 1. So if you don't want spoilers, come back next week. Yo-Jo. And if you're ready for spoilers, we're going to talk about the first episode of Riverdale on the CW, which...
A dramatic rethink of the clean-cut Archie characters.
And on this particular spectrum, what's weird, it may not be a spectrum, because Nick and I both kind of really enjoyed this.
Yeah, I did.
And Dave's a hater.
I thought that it was... well crafted and well produced. It did remind me of Veronica Mars, as some people had compared it to, but I never fell into that show. I think for some reason, teen drama type stuff, that sort of slightly heightened teen drama where sometimes kids sort of speak a little more adult like.
Yeah.
Sorry,
you hate Juno too.
It rings hollow to me.
Yeah.
But there was definitely some interesting stuff going on. I'm not a total hater on it. And let's just say what it begins with.
Okay, so it starts with what looks like an accident where Jason and Cheryl Blossom are out on the river.
These are not the most well-known characters.
No, they're incestuous twins in Afterlife with Archie, which is where I know them from.
Yep. Right. But they're essentially the wealthy, red-headed siblings of the Riverdale town. And kind of like she's like the queen bee cheerleader too.
Oh, I think that's a reinvention. So something happens. Jason dies. It seems like
he goes missing and is presumed dead.
And she says that they were out on the lake with this boat, and she dropped a glove. He went after it and he drowned. She's sort of in mourning. But yeah, she's turned into sort of the queen bee bitch of this. She's like she's the Veronica.
She's the super
right, and Veronica herself has more nuance.
And I really liked what they did. Veronica comes to town with her mom, having divorced her husband, who is apparently being indicted for securities fraud and all that kind of thing. She had a relationship with Archie's dad, played by Luke Perry, which I think is great casting. Yep. So she's sort of a black sheep returned home. Veronica's the same boat. She's sort of like was this rich girl living in New York, and now she's in this quaint little burg of Riverdale. And I thought they struck a really nice balance because I thought at first when they introduced her, which with Betty and Archie and Veronica, that Veronica was going to be kind of Veronica, you know, the snarky, bitchy.
The rich bitch.
And instead, she and Betty form a friendship that I really liked.
It's kind of unlikely.
She's kind of snobbish at times.
Right. But here's the thing. She says that, at one point she asks Betty, she's like, you've probably heard stories about me or something like that. And, you know, it's like, you know, manipulative rich bitch or something like that. And she's like, that's actually used to be true.
Yeah.
She's like, that is who I used to be. And she's like, making a concerted effort to not be that person.
Well, I mean, she stands up for Betty with Archie. She stands up for Betty at the cheerleading trials. Yep. Like, they are friends. And I like
that. But she also, do you think, Randy, she's aware, like, when she shows up, Archie's talking to Betty, and this is kind of a quintessential classic love triangle thing.
Yep.
And suddenly, but like all his attention drops because, you know, gorgeous Veronica, new girl walks in.
Yeah.
And it's like he barely even hears Betty. Now, do you think Veronica was aware of grabbing that attention? Because she does kind of start inserting herself into his life. She's attracted to him, obviously.
Yeah, I don't think so. I didn't read it that way. I read it as more of a, this guy's interesting. And then she did. I mean, the Veronica from the comics, I feel like,
she
would have...
She stands up for her in a very interesting way in those episodes.
The Veronica from the comics, I feel like, would have gotten in the way and sort of pushed Betty off the side.
Right, she's pretty straightforward. She's the kind of mean girl.
Also, love what they did with Kevin Keller.
Yeah.
They even riff on it. They're like, is the gay best friend still a thing? Like, they're making fun of it. But at the same time, he's a great character. And what they did with Moose was really fun.
Right. I did see that. That was pretty good. And I did see, you know, he is kind of the sort of gossipy, snarky gay best friend of Betty.
Yep.
Right? Betty, yeah.
Yep.
And at one point, Cheryl shows up, right? Cheryl, and she's kind of being an Uber bitch.
Yeah.
And he snarks at her. He's like, oh, I didn't realize what, like, you know, the queen bee is still a thing or something like that. Yeah. And she's like, oh, I didn't realize being gay best friend is still a thing.
Yep.
And he kind of like, his jaw drops because he's like, he's a snarky dude and he just got shut down.
Yep. I thought all these characters were well drawn. I actually, and also think their Archie is great.
Yeah.
He's interesting. I couldn't quite get a feel for him because he is like, he is football player, songwriter. He's kind of sensitive, but also like kind of a horn dog.
I think that's sort of what you're supposed to get from this character. He's kind of all over the map because he can't quite decide what he wants to be.
He's drawing a lot from Wade's Archie, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, this is written, the pilot's written by Roberto
Aguirre. I'd say Mark Wade's Archie from the current comics.
Yes. It's written by Roberto Aguirre Sagasa, who has been in charge of the books, who sort of spearheaded the new Archie and the new Jughead, and he's definitely incorporating. His Jughead is also really interesting because he's sort of the narrator of the piece.
He's the narrator.
He's like writing a book about this whole thing.
He's not a Jughead who's just like, I sure could go for a pepperoni pizza.
No, he's like the outsider, the cool outsider guy. And clearly he and Archie had some kind of falling out, which is interesting.
Yeah, I liked that twist.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting.
One thing I wondered is how much the show has to offer beyond its subversions of traditional Archie expectations.
I didn't really think that was necessarily a big part of it. I thought all the characters were well done. I mean, Aguirre Sagasa does have a... He was a playwright. He's a comic book writer. His stuff is a little larger than life. It feels like Berlanti, who's also a executive producer on this, it feels like, you know, Flash can sometimes be on the nose.
Right, sure.
It definitely had some of that to some extent. But in general, I found it likable. I liked all the interactions. The fact that it was Archie was sort of icing on the cake for me. It wasn't like the whole thing.
Yeah, I actually enjoyed the stories that were being told. And yeah, it was kind of cool to see, oh, that character and that character.
Yeah.
I think I liked the stories more.
And also, like, we haven't really seen much of the parents in the Archie. Like, Hiram Lodge is usually a deal. So seeing her mom be the character influencing Veronica is a big thing. And seeing Archie's dad a little bit more and being more of a character. I mean, Luke Perry brings a certain meta character to it,
right?
Which I think was a good choice.
You know, what I saw of him, I was pretty impressed with him. I thought he was doing some nuance to Archie's dad.
Also, I thought the Riverdale looked great. Yeah. They did a great job of giving it a look that's, it's not just like, what's that movie that was in black and white that had Reese Witherspoon and
Pleasantville.
It's not Pleasantville. They're not riffing on it. They're doing a sort of here's what a modern version of Riverdale would look like.
But I mean, it's got Pops
Chocolate Shop. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's got
right, but they also kind of acknowledge that, like, the old, like, an old malt shop or ice cream shop is kind of an outdated concept. Is it Betty or Veronica? One of them is like, what's a malt shop?
Veronica,
what's an ice cream?
Veronica's like, what's a chocolate shop and why does it have
burgers?
Yeah. But yeah, it's like a 24-hour diner, so it kind of makes sense.
And I like the inclusion of Josie.
Josie and the Pussycats. Yeah, that was a great bit, too. I like how they kind of shut Archie down. They're like, yeah, we're not here to help you.
Yeah, we're far off.
The only misstep, and I think it's kind of a big misstep, is the Mrs. Grundy thing. Because, for one thing...
for those who don't know Mrs. Grundy immediately, that's generally an old lady teacher in the comics, but is kind of a hot younger teacher who has an affair with Archie.
She has an affair with Archie, and that's leads in. I mean, I understand they wanted to give him some reason that Archie couldn't come forward with what he heard about the lake.
Yeah.
I feel like they could have done something else that this feels like.
Why didn't you like it? It seemed perfectly in keeping with the rest of the show to me.
Not to me. It felt like it was over the top. And also,
But student teacher relationships, that's like real thing. Do you think it impugned his goodness too much?
To some extent, yes. I also think it complicates Betty and Veronica beyond what needs complicating. Like, it's already complicated enough. You don't need to add in that he's attracted to an older teacher. Also, and this may be the biggest thing, these are 20-year-olds playing teenagers.
Right.
You can't have a 20-year-old playing a teenager and a 20-year-old playing a 20-year-old and then have them have an interaction like it's bad and not have us realize they're both the same age.
Right, right. It sort of makes the what would traditionally be kind of an uncomfortable, you know, like a 16-year-old and a 25-year-old or something, clear, obvious split.
Yeah.
When in reality, the actors are probably about the same age.
Yeah. It's kind of unfortunate.
But at the same time, I think that probably sort of works in their favor in the sense that they don't want to creep you out too much.
Yeah.
They want to just creep you out just a little bit.
Everyone that I've seen has been talking about this. The Miss Grundy thing does seem to be a sticking point for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And I do think it's one of those... I don't think they should have done it. I think it's a flaw in the show.
That seems weird to me. That's like, that was the least of my concerns.
It's interesting, because everything else felt pretty much right there with me, and CW to me, but this was like a little bit too far.
Well, see, I think it's what's interesting about it is that it sets up an interesting dynamics. Honestly, a straight Archie, Betty, and Veronica, even with the reinventions of those characters, would have been a boring love triangle. this kind of reveals that Archie is a guy who's maybe impulsive, and that his impulsiveness kind of is manifested in a more dangerous way this time.
Yeah, I wasn't bugged by it either.
I wasn't buying into it. I thought Miss Grundy's guilt over the whole thing was a little much. It was like...
I don't know. I think it's a good thing for the first episode to hang its hat on a suspense level, too, because, they could have invented something else, but, they basically, in the episode, they maybe heard what could have been a murder.
Yeah.
Overheard a gunshot. And it's because, they cannot reveal their affair. I'm like, that is something you truly would probably be willing to do just about anything to cover up as a kid and a teacher who doesn't want her career destroyed.
Yeah, sure.
It makes complete sense to me. Y'all are, although the show was mediocre to me, I think that was a perfectly valid choice.
Interesting.
So I have to say, the person who's playing Archie is 19 years old.
Oh.
The woman portraying Mrs. Grundy, she's 34 years old.
Is she really?
Yeah. She doesn't look it.
No, she doesn't. 34.
Yeah, that's a very youthful 34.
And Archie has clearly been hitting the gym so much, he looks like
a
college age.
I mean, the first time we see Archie, he has his shirt off.
Yeah, well, and then there's a whole thing where Keller's like, he's got abs.
Actually,
and that was kind of funny. Yeah. But yeah, I think that's the thing. Archie looks older than 13. She looks younger than 34. So they do look the same age.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But yeah, it's interesting to know that that's actually not the case.
Yeah, broadly speaking, except for me, people like this seem to like this show.
Yeah, everybody seems to like it.
And I can at least quasi recommend it. I especially recommend it for the Mrs. Grundy love triangle, or Miss Grundy, whatever she is.
I'm excited to see where they go with it and what avenues they want to explore. Outside the murder,
in the Grundyverse,
Solomon Grundy is going to be revealed to be Mrs. Grundy's father.
See, crossover with DC.
They're going to have a Flash, Arrow, Supergirl musical crossover.
I'm just wondering, do they bring in Sabrina? She's part of that universe.
That'd be funny.
I don't see this as doing any of the magic is real sort of stuff, but I could see her as a Wiccan.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, I can see that too. I think that'd be great.
And they would probably try and find, an interesting spin on it, not just, oh, she's the weird Wiccan girl or something like that.
Yeah.
I think they would probably find something interesting in it.
Yeah.
Well, I am impressed with what Aguirre Sacasa has brought back to Archie.
So. I think that's the thing, is that I was expecting pretty good from this, because even though for whatever reason I was not excited for it, all the Archie comics have been good, and CW's been pretty good, so I'm not surprised the two of them would come together and create something really entertaining.
Yeah.
So it's really good, unless you're Dave, in which case it sucks, except for the Mrs. Grundy part.
It's excellent lurid pulp if you like watching teen sex.
And who doesn't? All right, that'll do it for us this week. We'll be back next week with more, and until that time,
Yo, Joe!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating or review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.